Hello, we are the Oxford Society for International Development, and welcome to our new podcast series. My name is Mia Simovic, and I'm the co-president for Oxford in my second year studying geography. I'm delighted to be hosting the podcast today, and we are joined by Sanam Naraghi Andalini, an activist for women, peace and security, and the CEO and co-founder of the International Civil Society Action Network, also known as ICAN. ICAN is a charity that provides a shared global platform for women-led organisations active in peacemaking and security issues. The work of ICAN is wide-ranging, using storytelling, information exchanges, technological support and funds to enhance the impact of grassroots projects. Sanam spearheads the Women's Alliance for Security Leadership Programme, which aims to amplify women's voices in international peace and security policy by giving them direct access to resources and decision makers. She works closely with women living through conflicts, crises, and violent extremism. In the past, Sanam was the adjunct professor at the University of Columbia, and she does advisory work to the UN on the subject of women and conflict. She is currently the director of the Centre for Women, Peace and Security at LSE, the London School of Economics. Today on the podcast, we'll be exploring the role of women in the future of international peacemaking and development, and we will apply a gender lens to the COVID-19 pandemic. Sanam, thank you so much for joining me today and welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much. It's lovely to be here with you.
So I'd like to start by asking you what inspired you to work in the world of peacemaking and to co-found ICAN.
So two lines, if you want, in terms of how I got involved. I'm Iranian by background. I was 11 when the revolution kind of was a tsunami into our lives. And we left to go on holiday for 10 days to avoid all the strikes that were happening in the winter of 1978-79. And I didn't go back for 7 years. I didn't see my father for 7 years. And I never went back to live in Iran. I've traveled back there, obviously. But that was, it was really the end of one life and the beginning of another one. And you realize that when your own country has had a crisis, an internal crisis, and that is not resolved, ultimately, every decade of your life, you feel it in a different way. So, you know, as a teenager, it was one sort of sense of being isolated, and it was the Iran-Iraq War. In my 20s, when I was getting married, just simple things like trying to get visas and getting family over was a struggle. When my children were born, you know, they were separated from their grandparents. And then when people started dying, it's really hard. My dad was in Iran when he was sick, my uncles and my aunts. And this, the constant separation that we experience is something that has kind of been one of the foundation stones for the work that I do, because very ideally, I suppose, when I was in my 20s, I thought, I just don't want anyone else to have experienced the trauma that I experienced. And how does one work to transform conflicts? Because every country has conflict within it, but it doesn't have to become violent. It doesn't have to become a massive turmoil. So that's what drove me into the realm of peacemaking and peace building back in the 1990s. And then I became interested in the work of women because they're really at the forefront of dealing with these problems. I saw in my own life and in the years that I've worked globally all around the world that anytime a problem arises and there's a crisis, women are really the first ones to adapt, to respond, and to get involved in the issues, but they're often taken for granted. And specifically, women who become involved in the peace and security issues, it's very, very dangerous work to be reaching out to the other side. You know, conflict creates binary worlds. And to be the person who steps out of your own community to say, we need to see who the other side is and let's talk to them and find a human solution and a non-violent solution to the problem, takes a lot of courage. And so I've been inspired by and I've basically dedicated my work to elevating and recognizing and appreciating the work that women as peace builders do in war zones and contexts of fragility. And that's really what inspired me to start ICAN back in the early 2000s. Having seen that, you know, we did a lot of policy work at the UN, we got Resolution 1325, I did a lot of consulting and advisory work, and I continue to do that, but it's not the same as genuinely enabling and giving women peace builders the platform they need to engage on a more equal footing with a world that's beyond them.
Thank you. And in relation to your focus on women, you are the leader of the Women's Alliance for Security Leadership Programme, which is part of your work at ICAN. And you work with women, as you said, fighting for peace, but without the weapons. So could you talk us through some specific projects you've worked on and your role in the WASL project?
Thank you. So the WASL is basically a curated network, if you want, of women peace builders, and sometimes it's organizations that they had already created, sometimes through and with our support, they established their own organizations. But we have partners in Colombia, Yemen, Malaysia, Iraq, Syria, Nigeria, you name it, across the world where there is war or violent extremism, we probably have a locally rooted partner. They are what we say independent organizations, local to their own context and their own societies. And what we've done is we've tried to create a platform where we can provide three levels of support. So on the one hand, it's personal solidarity and connections. It's very, very lonely work getting involved in these kinds of issues. And to be able to connect, say, my colleagues from Nigeria who are dealing with Boko Haram returnees or communities affected by Boko Haram, together with my colleagues in Pakistan who are dealing with local Taliban movements in their own societies, enabling them to exchange ideas and information and just kind of what the experience is like, is very, very important. Similarly, it's about being able to say, hey, I'm here for you. So right now in the context of the COVID crisis, pretty much all of our partners, the minute they heard, they pivoted their work to doing awareness raising around hygiene, you know, washing your hands, making hand sanitizers, doing bags of food now for refugees and internally displaced populations and so forth. So we are there to say, we stand with you. We stand with you as peace builders. And then the second layer of the support is professional. And that's a combination of making sure that they have access to the policy world, because I sit in a very strange place of, on the one hand, having access to the UN and to the EU or to the governments that are the development aid providers, if you want. But I'm also talking to my colleagues on the ground who are living the reality. And these conversations are very often as if they're two parallel universes. And so connecting that and bringing the real frontline voices to that policy world is really, really important. And related to that is, you know, we provide trainings and capacity development in different issues. And then the third area of support is we set up the first, and it's still the only, global, independent, multi-donor fund supporting women's peace building and work around prevention of violent extremism. The way that we see it is that if my colleagues in Yemen are saying that what they need to do is help through their local networks fix water stations because people don't have access to water. And actually, as by fixing the water station, they're also helping to mediate disputes and conflicts between communities that wanted to use that water. And by then providing that water, they're also then talking to those communities about making sure that they send their daughters to school. So saying, you know, if you want to have access to this water pump, one condition is that you're sending your daughters, because often it's the girls who get left out of going to school, they get to go to school. So they understand, all of our partners understand their local context, and they have, they're trusted. They've been working, you know, maybe doing humanitarian work, really for mediating conflicts, et cetera, for decades. And what we do is, I call it investing in trust. They are trusted at the local level. I trust them and their judgment in terms of what they think is necessary now. And so it's really about channeling resources to them to be able to do their work effectively on the ground. And this happens, I'll give you, for example, in Afghanistan, a colleague of ours said to us a few years ago that she wanted to work with men to deal with issues of violence against women. We helped her design the approach and the kind of how to engage men in a positive, constructive way. I'd done research myself in 10 countries looking at these issues and developing my research methodology. So we helped her shape it. In the last few years, she's been doing this, and the dynamics of how those communities have changed because of her direct engagement with the imams, with the village chiefs, with young people, etc., in terms of changing their attitudes about anything from domestic violence all the way to joining the Taliban. So we trusted her, we helped her, but she's done the work and it belongs to them. They have total local ownership of the outcomes and the sustainability of what we've seen of funding or things that we helped 5 years ago is still continuing, because it's about mindset changes and attitude change as well.
So it seems like you're connecting a whole host of different scales. So people working at the grassroots, right up to the more macro scales of negotiating in peacemaking. I picked up on some things that you've said in the past about, instead of focusing on power sharing, you're focusing on responsibility sharing. And I was wondering if you could elaborate a bit more on what you mean by this and what you think the implications of the current models of peace building, perhaps at a more macro scale, have on the nature of the results, and also how you imagine an alternative model.
The language or the terminology of power sharing is itself very damaging, because if you're talking to people who have picked up weapons to fight for their interests, and they have been killing their own compatriots, right? Or destroying their own societies, if you want. To then say, okay, you get to come to negotiations and we will divide up the power, right? In terms of who's going to have this position and that position, or whether we're going to have a federal state and each state will have its own president or and so forth, or how many positions you're going to have per clan or per political party in parliament or in the cabinet and so forth. If the language of power, in a way, it denotes power for me, right? And if you're, if you're talking about people who've already used weapons to further their own interest, the sense of responsibility that comes with power is almost invisible. From the standpoint of the UN, I thought, well, why don't we talk about responsibility sharing? Why don't we flip it and say, if you want to be Minister of Finance or Minister of Foreign Affairs or, you know, Minister of Security, that means that you have a responsibility to providing security for your citizens. It means that you're going to be financing or looking at how you're going to be feeding people and dealing with infrastructure and so forth. So this flipping of, it's two sides of the same coin, but it's that reframing and the use of language and terminology, which I think is actually an important way of rethinking and reimagining what these negotiations should be about. And that's on one side. It's related to essentially my career over the last 25 years and the impetus for when I was advocating for Resolution 1325 with my other colleagues and the consultations we did, which is that essentially the international system that we have in place that came about after World War II was designed to stop those kinds of wars. It was designed to stop international, interstate wars. The UN is founded on the principle of non-interference and sovereignty of state. But since the 1990s, or since the end of the Cold War, what we've seen is civil wars, internal conflicts. And in internal conflicts, you may have a state actor, but you also then have non-state armed actors. And when I first started this work back in the 1990s, Nelson Mandela was labeled a terrorist, right? So the world did not talk to non-state armed actors or non-state independence movements and so forth. They were labeled as something sort of negative. It became very clear that, of course, you have to negotiate with them. And, of course, very often they have a legitimate grievance and a legitimate concern, as Mandela and the ANC proved. But the shift that we saw that has basically now become normalized, that, you have a conflict, you bring the state actors together with the non-state armed actors to the table, and they then have a negotiation which de facto ends up in, a power-sharing deal of some sort. That is insufficient. Those negotiation processes have repeatedly been proven to not be sustainable. The World Bank has studies. It's been, some 50% of them or more don't hold up over 5 years after the peace agreement has been signed. And part of the reason why that doesn't hold is because when you have conflicts that are within a country, it's not just being fought in a battlefield somewhere far away and then people come home. The war is being fought in people's homes, in people's neighborhoods, in people's communities, within families, when you have interracial families or interreligious families and so forth. And so to build peace, you actually need to reweave the social fabric of society. And you need people who understand what that is. And again, for me, what became evident was that this is where women become really important. That's what they're doing on the ground. So that was kind of one aspect of it in terms of rethinking and reimagining peace processes. But related to that, and again, if I bring it to the COVID question right now, if you take a place like Yemen or Syria, at the moment with the corona crisis pandemic ongoing, you have the Syrian government that is not allowing the passage of medical supplies. You have the Turkish side or the opposition side, you have places where they're not allowing civilians access to water stations. So if we think that those actors coming to the table are going to care about and are going to be responsible for the well-being of the citizens and the civilians and the refugees and the IDPs from Syria, I think we must be smoking something, right? So they've proven that they don't care. Therefore, we as an international community who are enabling and actually legitimizing them by inviting them to the table should be thinking about, well, who else is a legitimate actor? And if we see local civilians who have, again, chosen not to engage with weapons, but have chosen to engage in the conflict by dealing with the consequences, by trying to prevent the violence, by trying to prevent the fraying of society, etc., and have put their own lives at risk, they have a legitimate and a credible right, and we have a responsibility to put them at the table, and they should come in as independent delegations. So if we're having armed state actors and we're having armed non-state actors, we should have unarmed non-state actors as well in peace processes, because they are actors in the engagement of the conflict in terms of dealing with the consequences, but also in the fostering, sustaining, and building of the peace, which is essentially what really needs to happen if we want to get out of violence and towards a sort of a transformed notion of dealing with conflict and difficulties in societies.
So you've been talking essentially also about flipping the processes that are happening now on their head, and including peace actors rather than just conflict actors into the negotiations. And so you're also talking about quite a radical reevaluation of the voices at the peacemaking tables. What do you think the implications are if these voices do reach the tables and are shouting loud and clear?
My argument often is that at the moment, the ticket to a peace talks is how violent can you be? Right. That's if Afghan women picked up weapons and started killing everybody, they would be invited to the next Doha talks as an independent delegation of some sort. So that's the there's a total illogic and irrationality in terms of how we design things right now. We need the armed actors. They are necessary to be there because we need them to stop being violent, but they are not sufficient. Now, the research on the other side also proves, I did in my own work, the first piece of work I did was back in 1999, in the run-up to getting Resolution 1325, I interviewed women in 15 countries where these women had been at the negotiations table to say, you know, what was the difference in terms of their presence there? What did they bring substantively? How did it change the dynamics of the conversations and so forth? And that was a publication for the UN. It's called Women at the Peace Table Making a Difference. And then after that, I led a 15-country study where we said, let's look at the contributions of women in terms of security issues, in terms of governance issues, so disarmament, security sector reform, transitional justice issues, and so forth. And we did deep field research, 15-country case studies that came out. Again, very clear demonstration of how women contribute to these processes. So for example, in terms of disarmament, we looked at El Salvador, and we looked at Liberia, and we looked at Sierra Leone. And the role that women played in combination of collecting weapons, dealing with returning fighters, especially the young fighters, or sacrificing in El Salvador, women who had been commanders, sacrificing their own positions and their own benefits to help the men rehabilitate. And then what they were doing in their own communities in terms of recovery and development. So in all of that work, it was clear demonstration of what a difference it makes to have women peace builders and women engaged in these processes. Then there were statistical studies done by 2012, 2014 that look at peace agreements that have been signed, which ones have sustained themselves, or which ones have had more provisions implemented. And over the studies show that where you have had effective engagement of women, and it's basically sort of women's civil society movements that are engaged in the peace process, they have been more systematic and more sustainable. So we have the evidence, we have the people. We just have an incredibly slow diplomatic setting, if you want, and the inertia that reverts back to some traditional ways of doing business, which are completely outdated for the 21st century.
Fantastic. To bring us back to the coronavirus pandemic as a study, in lots of other crises, we've seen a rise in things like hate speech and xenophobia, increase in poverty, suffering, violence if people are unwell. There's even been, in this case, a release of prisoners convicted of war crimes, and also some increase in oppressive measures to restrict the actions of civil society. But the home can often be the most dangerous place of all, and we've seen quite a high rise in domestic violence. So could you talk a little bit about what the implications are, potentially the gendered implications are of the COVID-19 pandemic?
Sure. So a few things. I think number one, obviously what we see around the world is that women are at the forefront of healthcare provision, whether it's in hospitals and in the medical sector or in, you know, elderly homes, or frankly at home, right, in the domestic sphere, in places where there isn't the medical infrastructure. So they're at the forefront of that, dealing with these issues. Often it's unpaid work or very low paid work. We all know about the problem of the PPE, you know, the lack of covering and protective gear. And so that's one dimension. On the other hand, it's a phenomenon which is still being studied around how actually more men than women are dying from the disease. And so we need to understand the medical dimensions of that. But It also has long-term implications. If we look at what it's going to mean in terms of having a higher rate of female-headed households in countries where women don't get to have inheritance or don't have their own income and so forth, what will the shifts and changes be to allow families that may have lost the breadwinner to be able to cope in the aftermath? So those are some of the gender dimensions. On the question of the violence, domestic violence, this is an issue that certainly in my line of work, with a focus on contexts or situations of fragility and crisis, we see this all the time, that when there's a crisis, levels of domestic violence go up. And it's a complicated set of issues, but I think that we need to think about it at least in a few dimensions. Number one, the first thing is we must talk about it in terms of this is somebody, a person, there is a subject, right, who is being violent towards someone else. So often domestic violence or sexual violence is talked about in the passive tense. You know, she was raped. As if it's an airborne disease or something. No, these are people choosing or moving towards a violent reaction. And then we have to look and say, okay, what's why? What is it that's happening? And it's incredibly complicated to understand why and how it is that we get a percentage of predominantly men, not always just men, but predominantly men, not having the coping skills or the ability to express their own frustration, depression, anger, et cetera, in any other way other than violence. You know, why is it that they allow themselves to be violent? Why has society allowed us to tolerate and accept that, whether it's in England or anywhere else in the world? How do we respond to this, both in the immediate terms of protecting people, but also in terms of engaging with men to prevent it and give them the skills and the tools to process their own anger and their own frustrations. I did a 10-country study for UNDP about back in 2008, 2009, looking at the issue of young men getting involved in violence. And it was a very interesting mix of factors that come into play. It's important that we recognize that we often talk about the sort of pressures on women, but we also need to understand what's going on with men in societies. And in a very sort of summarized way, one of the things that we found was that when men lose their the normal notions of what manhood is defined by, and for a lot of when I would ask them what does it mean to be a man, being a provider was one of the first things that people would say. You have to be able to provide. You have to have a livelihood. Having prestige, having social prestige, and having a role in society and the kind of job that is respected, that was another thing. Being a protector, which sometimes would warp into a warrior mode, was a role. And then being a procreator, if you want, displaying masculinity through having more children. So you have these notions, but there is pressure on them to conform. And when you have men stuck at home and they're not able to either, whether they've lost their jobs, whether they're drinking, whether they are frustrated by the fact that they don't think it's their job to deal with the housework. There's a sort of entitlement or something that, why should I do this? I'm not being paid for it, or I'm not, it's her job. All of these things contribute to why and where we see levels of violence going up, but it's rooted in social cultural issues as well as psychological issues, because of course it's not, we can't just say all men are doing this. It happens to be some men, pockets of men that are going on, that are in this space. And I would love to see more men engaged in this issue of men's violence. This is not a women's issue. This is a societal issue, and it should be something that we get men talking to men about it and being engaged in the conversations.
On the topic of violence, you've also done a bit of work on violent extremism, which you've already brought up. And in the context of crises in social instability, there tends to be an increase also in extremism, particularly when state and international actors fail to respond or provide support for people on the ground. Extremist groups tend to fill this vacuum and offer things like food, protection, education even. So, with some examples, do you think certain extremist groups are using COVID-19 to leverage support and recruit? And how should the international community, grassroots organizations, the state react to prevent the rise in extremism?
So we definitely see it. I mean, we see the white right movements here, the white supremacists here in the US right now, heavily armed, challenging the state level. And then at the same time, I'm hearing from my colleagues in Pakistan, in Indonesia, elsewhere, that there is very active engagement. Some of the Islamist, the more extremist Islamist, the ones that claim to be Islamist, they're not, they're Salafi and Wahhabi groups predominantly, but both online and on the ground. And what's happening is that, so if we think about extremism, identity-based extremism, which is the phenomenon that we deal with right now in our world. These are movements that elevate one form of identity above others, right? So white supremacists, it's, you know, you have to be sort of white, right? So, or Islamist ones will say, you know, Muslims first and everybody else second. And they try and diminish your other forms of identity. We all have multiple identities, but these guys try and sort of say, this is the most important thing. Nothing else matters. This is how we connect with each other. And what they are doing right now is that they are tapping into the absence or the lack of, or the paucity, if you want, of state services and saying, look, we told you the state is no good, right? They're unjust. They don't provide. Come and we will provide for you. So that's a way of building loyalty. The reason why they're able to do this actually is that we've had 40 years of structural adjustment where the state social services have been shrunk in so many countries and religious groups and these non-state groups have filled that void. But they're now reasserting themselves in that space. So kind of providing food, providing services to people at a time of need, which is a way of building loyalty. And then related to that is online, they're framing it as the state is lying to you, it's a conspiracy, or we have a variety of different things that we hear across the world. So in some places, people they're being in Somalia, for example, our colleagues say, they're saying, Muslims don't get it. Muslims don't get COVID. Don't listen to the state, right? So it's tapping into people's mistrust of the state to give them an alternative message and sort of try and build or shore up loyalty at the same time as arguing that the state is not there to provide for you. We are here for you. And this is a way of building up support. So it's dealing with the grievances and exacerbating on some level. On the other hand, it's also a way of giving people a sense of feel good. If I sit and watch Fox News here in the US, I would feel very happy because, you know, you listen to it and you think that nothing really bad is going on and that we're all going to be safe. If you listen to the White House's spiritual guidance leader right now, it's this lady, she's calling for divine intervention. It's very nice, or feels, I suppose, for some people, it feels very good to think that all they need to do is wait for the Almighty to come and help, or somebody somewhere is going to come and deal with them, and they can put all the blame on the people they don't like, right? And that's the other sort of part of underlying racism that comes out across the world. I mean, whether it's the US blaming the Chinese, or pointing fingers here and there, or in Iran, there was, for example, a case of chap on television thinking that it was a Baha'i conspiracy coming out of California. Everybody wants to blame somebody else for the mess that we're in. And it becomes this kind of stereotypical trope of bringing back essentially deeply racist attitudes. And that's very dangerous because we live in the most extremely pluralistic societies ever in the history of humanity, in any town, village you get across the world. And we have to respect each other. We have to recognize that actually we're all human and it doesn't matter what your race or religion is, you can get the disease. But it's very, very dangerous right now in terms of how both at the state level, but also amongst these you know, religious, ethno-national groups, they are trying to sort of divide us instead of unite us.
And this is really important. Also, you mentioned the increased use of online spaces and social media, remote working, given that a lot of people are in lockdowns all over the world. Has this changed the way that terms like extremism manifest? And also how we deal with the rise in xenophobia, which is happening more intensely online?
Definitely they're really good online. I mean, they've been incredibly effective online. But everywhere you look, that it's a mixture of online and then in-person connections, right, that in terms of how they pursue the agenda. From the alternative side, I see two sets of, I mean, there are many reasons, many things that we need to be doing differently, but just in terms of the response side, again, there's a framing question which I have a real issue with, which is that if you look at the global UK discourse, international, at the UN discourse on these issues, it's framed as we are involved in countering or preventing violent extremism. We went from countering terrorism, which was very sort of security oriented, towards countering violent extremism to saying, well, actually, we need to prevent it before it arises. But we don't have a clear definition of what violent extremism is. There isn't an agreed international definition of it in the same way that there isn't for terrorism. And the negative framing doesn't help. All it's saying is we want to stop X, right? It doesn't actually say, what are we for? Again, we need to stop X. That's necessary. But it's not sufficient. We need to be articulating and then acting on our articulation of what are the values and what are the principles and what's the society we want. These guys, when they recruit, they tap into, as I said, they tap into grievances and aspirations, right? So they say, you come and join us and you will have justice, you'll have belonging, you'll have security, you'll have you know, all these, the, you know, it, whether it's the truth or whether it's just lies is irrelevant. The point is that they tap into that and they understand that people want aspirations. On our side, we have, again, we've had decades of talking about human rights, equality, dignity, women's rights, etc. But actually, we're not delivering. Our, you know, the policies that we've had in place and the programs do not deliver. That's very obvious for people to see because that because of the inequalities that they're experiencing. So, A, we have to be saying, what is it that we're for? And B, we have to follow through and implement those types of values so that people on the ground can really feel and see it, whether they're in England or, as I say, you know, whether they're in Uganda or Sri Lanka or elsewhere. In our work, we've come up with a framing, which is, I call it the PREP framework. And it's, the first P is for peace, which is we need to be establishing systems in place, both through the educational process, but also governance processes, where we really, really articulate the fact that when we have differences, when conflict arises, it can be resolved through dialogue. It can be resolved by talking and negotiating and mediating. We don't have to be violent about it, right? So that has to be across the system from the beginning to end. The R is for resilience. We will, and we, as we see with this pandemic, have to deal with crises and shocks in our lives, whether it's on a personal level, whether it's on a community level or a national level or international level. What are the provisions? What are the skill sets that we need to have for our kids, for the younger generation and so forth to cope with these things? And this goes back to the domestic violence as well. Mental health care, skills, you know, it's, I always say that I would like your generation to not only be, you know, brilliant lawyers if someone's going to be a lawyer, but maybe you also need to be really good at, you know, have certification as a chef or a landscaper, because who knows what's going to happen in life and you might need to pivot and earn your income doing something else. So resilience in terms of skills along the way. Resilience in terms of community structures. We're seeing right now with COVID that it's very, very locally oriented, right? So imagine if at every local community we had people who were trained in healthcare and provisions so that they could respond more quickly, whether it's the tracing and tracking, whether it's the prevention and mitigation side of the or the care side. So that sort of resilience of having community infrastructures that are then connected upwards to the state and internationally. Equality is a given. I'm like equality across whether it's gender, race, sexuality. We are all equal, and that should be something that we should be elevating across the board. And then pluralism, that the last P is for pluralism because of the fact that not only we're living in societies where you have, you know, different people from different backgrounds, but all of my own children are half Italian, half Iranian, brought up in America. We carry multiple identities with us all the time, and this should be celebrated. Our diversity is beautiful, and our pluralism is beautiful, but we're also unified. Thinking about how we restructure our lives and our values around this concept of PrEP would do a lot for dealing with the problems that extremism is seeding in society.
And this feeds back really nicely to some more specific projects you're doing with the Women's Alliance for Security Leadership. Could you explain to us a bit more about how the women and the women's organisations you're working with are championing these values and providing an alternative, particularly in places that are conflict-ridden, people are feeling very unstable?
Oh, absolutely. So, for example, in Nigeria, we have a colleague who is herself, she's a very highly respected local community leader, Islamic scholar, but we helped her with a funding from the UK originally. And she said she wanted to do radio, local radio shows, where she would bring Islamic scholars to talk about what Islam says about education, because, you know, Boko Haram says book is haram. You know, you don't go, education is not allowed, or it's sort of framed as West schooling is not allowed. And what she did with the Islamic scholars was that she brought them together and introduced them to sort of some of the concepts of peace building that we have around tolerance and as a pluralism and equality and so forth, and asked them to look for this within Islamic texts. And they found it, right? It's all there. It's in the Quran. It's in the Bible. Everything, they could find the same references. And then brought them onto the radio so that they could talk about these things. And people would call in and ask questions. And essentially they had, in the 15-week period, they had a 40% increase in school enrollment in that area, in Maiduguri, in northwestern Nigeria. Subsequently, she started working with women and girls who were basically, many of them had been abducted or sort of ended up joining Boko Haram because of family connections and so forth. But a lot of the girls that had been abducted over the years and brainwashed, who had then left or who had somehow escaped, and found that nobody was really engaging with them. So she started doing a mix of psychosocial care, livelihoods, reinterpretation of, you know, the religious texts and so forth, and has created networks for them to be able to reclaim and kind of live a peaceful life with the children that they've had. Our colleagues in Pakistan are doing very similar work with women who originally were recruited on the radio by sheikhs on the radio who said, you know, there's injustice and you know, we're going to create a world where there's going to be justice and, you know, you will be heard. I mean, the angle on feminism is quite interesting because they tap into women's sense of grievances to recruit them. So these women, to begin with, were, you know, giving their gold and then sending their sons off to join the Taliban. And once they saw that the situation is violent, our colleagues have been, over the years, have worked with them and have given them, again, a mix of psychosocial care, sense of belonging, sense of purpose, income and livelihood. It's got to be locally and contextually based. It's this holistic approach and building of, if you want, the social capital and the mindsets and so forth, which then end up being incredibly productive and constructive and helpful at that community level in terms of building back the social cohesion.
Just on a final note, I'm looking into the future of international peace and the way that we go about it. What do you see are the problems in the next 10, 15, 50 years that you'll be having to face with your organization? And how do you think you'll be able to cope?
Well, I don't know about the next 50 years, but I can tell you that according to BOND, the umbrella organization of UK development agencies, already 40% of charities in the UK that do development, international development work, are facing a threat because of the economic conditions that we're experiencing right now with the COVID crisis. So I think the sector itself is going to be, it's a bit of a sort of earthquake in terms of what is going to be happening and how things settle down. But I do think that the biggest shift that has to be made is the recognition that our job as organizations sitting abroad, our job really has to be to build and strengthen and sustain the local organizations so they can operate independently, and that we are essentially working ourselves out of a job. You know, my hope and my prayer is that by strengthening the local infrastructure and not using bombs to deal with the problems, if we can sustain and channel resources for genuine economic, social development, that will be the most effective way of using scarce resources and from the donor community. But also it's the best way of helping and bringing about human security, which is really what we need right now. We need a shift away from this very militarized notion of national security, which has dominated our lives since 9/11, and go towards a much broader sense of human security is national security. And it doesn't come through missiles. It comes through having piles of enough masks and health infrastructures and enough beds in hospitals and enough hospitals and clinics and so forth. So it's that complete shift that I would like to see. And at the core of it is a sense of human dignity and empathy. That doesn't matter whether you are, again, sitting in London or whether you're sitting in Kampala or Colombia, as a man, as a woman, as a boy, as a girl, as whatever identity you want to call yourself, we are all human beings, and we have similar aspirations and similar hopes. And the vast, vast majority of the public, actually, are really good and decent. And if we could only take that majority and have that be the way that we articulate ourselves, as opposed to allowing the tiny, tiny minority that will use violence and will and want to sow hatred and fear to be the ones that drive the agendas. I think those kinds of shifts would be incredibly helpful to see. But I think that's very realistic, but probably maybe people will think that I'm too idealistic.
Well, on that very positive note, thank you so much for talking to us today. It's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you about some incredibly interesting issues. And so thank you again, Sanam.
Thank you very much.
And that's all from us. Thank you for listening to Oxid's official podcast. Please head over to our website, oxid.org, or check out our Facebook page. For any of our listeners who are interested to find out a bit more about ICAN and Sanam's work, please take a look at icanpeacework.org or the LSE website. We've attached links to both in the blurb. A big thank you to Lorcan Cudlip Cook for the music. This has been Mia Simovic for the Oxford Society for International Development. I hope you've enjoyed this episode, and please join us next time.